Hey, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. With me today for the third time is Dr. Datis Karazian, who, in my opinion, is one of the most brilliant minds in the entire field of medicine and health at this moment in time. He's a thought leader. He's a pioneer. He's one of the absolute most respected people in all of functional medicine, and really where I would say a huge portion of functional medicine doctors and experts that are out there today have gotten their training from. So he's an amazing, humble, and yet extremely, extraordinarily brilliant guy. And I'm personally honored and very lucky to call him a friend and somebody that I can reach out to and have conversations with and learn from. And let me tell you a bit about his sort of formal training and background. He's a clinical research scientist, academic professor, and a functional medicine healthcare provider. He is associate clinical professor at Loma Linda University School of Medicine and a research fellow at Harvard Medical School and a researcher at the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Karazian has earned a Master of Science degree in Human Nutrition from the University of Bridgeport, a Doctor of Chiropractic degree from Southern California University of Health Sciences, and a Master of Medical Sciences degree in Clinical Investigation from Harvard Medical School. He's also earned a PhD degree in Health Science with concentrations in Immunology and Toxicology, and a Doctor of Health Science degree from Nova Southeastern University, and he completed his postdoctoral research training at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. And as you can imagine, with a list of credentials like that, he has a full alphabet soup of letters after his name, and it is absolutely very well deserved. Again, one of the most brilliant minds in all of human health, in my opinion. So, with no further ado, I hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation and podcast with Dr. Datis Karazian, and I think you're going to get a lot of very valuable insights from listening to this episode. Enjoy. So welcome, Dr. Karazian. Such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so first of all, there's a lot of talk of mitochondria these days, and yes, we've had 10, 20 years now of research that has really brought to the forefront the importance of mitochondria. For a long time, it was kind of just, hey, this is one of many organelles in the cell. It's the powerhouse of the cell, quote unquote, and you know, it takes in carbs and fats, pumps out ATP, and that's sort of all you need to know about those little mitochondria in your cells. And right, now we've had a couple decades of research that have really put mitochondria to the forefront of discussions around health and many, many different diseases. So, and there's also sort of, I would say, different stories, different narratives and paradigms that have been presented around mitochondrial health. I'm curious, just to start this, how do you see mitochondria in the overall picture of human health and disease and longevity? How would you describe their role?
Yeah, that's a good question. So ultimately, when you look at the studies on longevity, the key thing that they find with centenarians and people that are living healthy lifespans without chronic illness is that they have resiliency. And resiliency could be like, you know, temperature resiliency, they could be immune resiliency, blood sugar resiliency, cognitive resiliency, physical exercise resiliency. And resiliency can easily translate to how effective the mitochondria is in those systems. And even though the mitochondria gets, you know, focused in as the energy powerhouse of the cell and it makes energy, but it is a cell signaling unit. I mean, the mitochondria does trigger the initial stress response. The mitochondria does initiate through different proteins, you know, normal immune activation for an infection, and it generates heme to produce hemoglobin. I mean, it's like what we need to recover. And, you know, in a clinical setting, you can even go down to say, not only just longevity mechanisms of aging, but a person's ability to recover is like directly related to the fitness of their mitochondrial systems. So if you have, let's say, two different people, say one person had a traumatic brain injury, one person has a chronic viral infection. Let's say both people have the same things. One, like an example of a traumatic brain injury for both people. Well, the one that has greater mitochondrial efficiency is probably going to recover faster. Mm-hmm. Someone has a viral infection, the one that has probably greater mitochondrial integrity is going to recover faster. So whatever this condition is and our ability to heal ourselves, homeostasis, is all energy dependent. So, you know, if you look at any, you know, if someone looks up any biochemical pathway and sees all those diagrams and charts, like that all runs on ATP. And then the mitochondria we have are directly impacted by the things we do in our life. So, you know, we have to be able to make mitochondria, mitochondrial biogenesis. That requires activation. You have to be able to clear mitochondria, mitophagy, and, you know, things like lack of sleep or, you know, overeating or hormone deficiencies. All these things can impact how we clear out these different hormones, these mitochondrial proteins and structures. So it's one of those things where, as a clinician, the biggest clue for us is they come in and they say they have fatigue. And then we're like, okay, the mitochondrial system is inefficient. And then the question is, well, what kind of fatigue do you have? And then, you know, the next question is, what do you do? And ultimately, when we look at the mitochondria from a clinical perspective, the mitochondria has needs. The mitochondria has to have glucose, right? Or ketones, one or the other. But let's just stay with glucose for now. But if it has glucose, and then, you know, it's what it needs, the substrate to run its processes. If someone gets fatigued after meals or gets shaky headed between meals, we already know a mechanism where the mitochondria can't function. The mitochondria needs oxygen. So if someone has asthma and we hear wheezing and they have some allergies that are up respiratory, we know their mitochondria is going to be inefficient. Someone has anemia and they can't carry oxygen to the mitochondria, we already know there's not going to be a chance for recovery. You know, in a clinical setting, we have like deal breakers, like there's no way they're going to be able to recover because their mitochondria isn't able to produce ATP and get those things to work. We know the mitochondria is extremely sensitive to free radicals, oxidative stress. So like chemical loads, things that create the inflammatory response, depletion of antioxidants, those things all cause the mitochondria to fail. So what we're trying to do in a clinical setting is start to dissect that, what's the cause of their fatigue, how many mechanisms they have that are causing their expression of fatigue, because fatigue is basically a clinical window of mitochondrial efficiency. So, you know, people that have great mitochondrial function are the ones that aren't tired, the ones that recover, that can recover quickly from workouts. So when we hear things like, I can't focus for a period of time, or I can't work out like I used to, or I can't recover from my workouts, those are a clue to us that their mitochondrial systems are inefficient. And typically it starts with loss of endurance first. So it'll be like, I can't run like I used to, right? And that's muscular mitochondria. I can't read as many chapters as I used to. I can only read like 3 pages in fatigue. That's brain mitochondria. So whatever system we're looking at, what we'll see is mitochondria fails is fatigue is like endurance issues first, and then it gets into progressive fatigue. And the way I kind of look at my patient population is when they tell me they have fatigue, is what are the other things that may be red flags of what the mitochondria needs that we need to find? Do they have intermittent fatigue? Do they have fatigue all the time? Or is it debilitating fatigue? And debilitating fatigue, we're worried about things like cancer, malignancy, autoimmunity to the mitochondria, which we see with people that have, you know, like the so-called chronic fatigue patterns and my, you know, things like that. That's kind of the thought process. I just kind of rambled on, but you answered a question. I started talking.
No, that was great. And I love that you've presented resiliency at the beginning of your answer as a sort of foundational aspect of your answer, because this term resilience is something that is obviously incorporated in modern vocabulary, but it's typically framed as a purely psychological concept, as something that happens in the mind. It's like, how resilient are you? But there's a physiological basis to resilience. And as you said there, it's all about stress buffering capacity at the cellular level. And stress buffering capacity is essentially the synonymous with energy production capacity. How much energy can your cells produce to meet the demands that are on them from those stresses, which relates to your ability to not only handle the stress, but also you gave the example of like traumatic brain injury or viruses or things like that. How quickly can you bounce back, which is, you know, oftentimes the difference between bouncing back or not bouncing back, being stuck in chronic illness, if you have such a degree of overwhelm of your cellular capacity for bouncing back.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you look at a chronic patient, the person who's gone through the healthcare system and they're getting all these different diagnoses and no one can really figure out what's going on, and one from practitioner to the next, the key thing is they don't have the ability to recover, whatever it is. Then the question is, why do they not have the ability to recover? And then you can go to different pathways. But one of the key things is ultimately what's causing the mitochondria to not function. to not work. And then, it can be a whole list of things. And that's where it could be a little confusing. Where things go wrong is where, like, people will hear about mitochondrial dysfunction. They go, oh, we need some CoQ10. Mm-hmm. We had some CoQ10 and we had like really fancy niacin or niacinamide and, nutrients like that, or pycnogenol or something, like everything is going to work. And it's like, no. Because in the clinical setting, when we see chronic patients, they're coming in with bags full of supplements. They're, they're not, it's not a supplement deficiency issue. For some people, taking various nutraceuticals can maybe give them some minor function, and maybe help on the recovery pathway, but you really have to treat the underlying mechanism of what's happening. So usually when people can't recover, it's like this load of various things that are causing the mitochondrial to not function. And then the basic things we already know, like we know people need to have sleep. We know people have to have movement. We know people have to have nutrients and healthy diet. We know people need to have relationships. All these things actually have been shown to impact mitochondrial function, whether it's biogenesis or mitophagy or these different pathways. Now, ultimately, like for me, I see a lot of patients that have traumatic brain injuries that I work with. We're trying to help them recover. We'll see patients that have like chronic illnesses and they can't recover. And the first question is, can they make mitochondria? And how do you get mitochondrial biogenesis? So how do you make more mitochondria? Because we can change our mitochondrial concentration in our tissues and cells by things we do, right? So if you look at the literature, what they're looking at is the signaling agents for mitochondrial biogenesis. And for the most part, they really tend to be things like antioxidants, as things like green tea, things like resveratrol. They turn on the cellular messengers that can theoretically produce mitochondria, but they don't produce mitochondria. They just turn on the messenger pathways. And then what you actually need to have to produce mitochondria is activation. So you actually have to stimulate movement and you have to have hormesis and the stress to the system to make those things work. Yeah. So,
the analogy that I often use is building muscle. It's like, you're not going to build muscle unless you've created the demand that right. makes your body want to adapt to that demand by building more muscle.
Exactly. And it's the same thing when we do like neurological rehabilitation after someone had a stroke or injury. And the question is like, what can't you do? I can't walk in a straight line. Perfect. That's your rehab.
Exactly.
You touch my nose. Exactly. That's what you're going to do. Exactly. You get hurt, your brain you've injured now has to reconnect, and mitochondria is necessary. So as you keep activating those pathways, you're going to stimulate mitochondrial biogenesis. So I think one of the key things that's missing in the clinical world, especially in the world of nutrition, is just focusing on dump, like a supplement dump, like a hormone dump, like clearing toxins, and not really discussing activation and what things are. So like back to the scenario, if a person can't read a chapter, they can only read 3 pages. The typical thing is, oh, I read 3 pages, I'm done. It's like, no, you're going to get your gain when you read 3.5 pages and then maybe 4 pages. They keep pushing that system, and that's how you actually stimulate mitochondrial biogenesis. So mitochondrial biogenesis is the key thing. Now, interesting thing also is physical activity and movement has been shown to build mitochondria through all different tissues in the body. It's not just specific for the muscles. So, they find like liver mitochondria concentrations go up when people do physical activity and exercise. So one of the key things is there has to be some kind of movement. There has to be some type of activity tolerable to what the person can handle, And I remember meeting a mentor a long time ago of mine. He goes, listen, when someone gets sick, you got to get them to move or they'll never recover. I don't care if they throw them in a lake, on a barrel and they're just paddling away or whatever they need to do. Yeah. And I've actually used an analogy. I've had some patients that have been severely ill, like just lie on your bed and just move your arms and legs for as long as you can. Yeah. And then that's it. And then recover and then try to do that several times throughout the day. And as they do that, they're building mitochondria throughout their whole system. Like a sedentary lifestyle is going to completely impact the potential for mitochondrial biogenesis, but you don't have to be super athlete. Like you just have to work to your level of whatever fitness you have and then push it a little bit more. And that causes this hormesis effect. And it's the same thing with brain. Like if a person damaged their cerebellum and they have balance issues, we just have them work on their balance system for whatever level of time they can before they start to get dizzy and then they back off. But if that action doesn't take place, like that stimulation to turn on these protein messenger pathways, their proteomic pathways to generate the activation of mitochondrial biogenesis, where you actually turn on these production of these, people cannot recover. So this is the problem with the supplement game. And so forth. Now, there are some people that are so severely mitochondrial compromised where you may have to take down their inflammatory load before they can move and do things, right? There's people like, I've had patients that say, I can't, if I go outside to get the mail, I'll be in bed for the rest of the day. Like, I can't do that yet. And those are like the most severe kinds. So, you know, for them, you might, you know, we have to kind of reduce their load with other factors first, and then, but then encourage them to go get the mail and get some movement. Yeah. And it's like, there has to be some degree of hormesis or suffering to turn on these mitochondrial biogenesis pathways. And I think that's one of the biggest things I see neglected in the, you know, in the clinical setting world, is emphasis on everything besides that.
This is why I love you, Dr. Ghorazian. This is what you just talked about is something I've been talking about for years. And it is my criticism, my constant criticism of the functional medicine space, because very few people have really understood mitochondrial biogenesis and its importance and the role of hormesis in that. There's so much of, I feel, you know, mitochondria have sort of come into vogue now. Everybody's talking about it. But for the most part, the paradigm is sort of, hey, you know, you probably have mitochondrial dysfunction, and we'll run these organic acid tests and maybe a mito swab test or maybe something else. And based on that, we'll determine you have mitochondrial dysfunction. So here's some B vitamins, some alpha lipoic acid, some CoQ10, and some PQQ. And you know, that's the solution. That's the protocol for mitochondrial dysfunction. And it's like, no, we have so many lines of evidence showing that essentially the modern lifestyle causes a loss of about 75% of the mitochondrial capacity by the time a person is 70 years old. There's this massive atrophy in the same way that a muscle atrophies if you immobilize it, put it in a cast. It's the same thing is happening internally at the mitochondrial level. We have to rebuild that cellular engine. And I'm so glad that you've emphasized the importance of hormesis in your answer there. I'm wondering if you can speak to kind of a little bit more in depth of the typical functional medicine paradigm of mitochondria and mitochondrial dysfunction and how most practitioners are attempting to treat it.
Well, just like you said, there you're going. There's something wrong with mitochondria. Let's do an organic acids test, or the urinary, and they see this beautiful map. The lab points out different metabolites of mitochondria, and then here's dysfunction. Like, you need zinc. That's a ridiculous model. I actually remember talking to one of these labs that does it. They go, "Why are you selling this nonsense? Like, it's so ridiculous. Like, this is not how this works. You're not capturing true mitochondria with your urine." Outputs, it's not happening in the cellular level. Jumping to like a single nutrient for that is like clinically, who wrote this? A real clinician never wrote any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it sounds like it's very scientific, and I think people are drawn with that. And, you know, there's a point where I just almost have given up on healthcare practitioners too. I'm an educator, but I'm like, how could you not critically think? Like, why do you think?
Yeah. So many of them are just protocol followers, and they don't think.
Right. And it's like, how do you think the metabolite in the urine is like telling you what's happening in the cellular space? And then what happens to the practitioner, to the patient, is they get a supplement overload of stuff. They get all this money spent on extra diagnostic testing. They may not still have any outcomes or benefits, or maybe one supplement actually helped them, but it was totally unrelated to the lab test. Mm-hmm. It's just something their body like responded to, and then like, oh, must be working. And I think if a practitioner gets a few of those accidentally, then, you know, they'll see how it works. And in particular, I'm not a big fan of the organic acids test. I think most of those metabolites, first of all, from a laboratory perspective, working in lab as a PhD student, they're not reproducible. Like, a lot of these markers are terrible. Like, if you measure the person at different times, if you even do the same biomarker the same day, they're not that effective. So now it's like, if you take someone and gave them like a dice and said, I'm going to give you a dice test, and every time 6 comes up, I want you to use CoQ10. Every time 1 shows up, I want you to use a multivitamin product or whatever. And someone comes in and go, you got a 6. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're going to go on this. And then eventually there's going to be some people that maybe it helps, but it doesn't mean the testing was accurate. So I think that's the level of frustration I also have. The biggest clinical indication that a patient's mitochondria is improving is their endurance for whatever they couldn't do improves, and their fatigue, or if their energy levels themselves can be changed. But first, it's going to start with endurance. So now they can do things longer, now they don't fatigue as much, whatever it may be, Right. So that's the key thing. And resiliency. So now they can eat maybe a meal and they're not totally passing out. Now they can go 3 hours without a meal and their blood sugar is not dropping. Now they can lose a night's sleep and they're not getting the cold the next day. Now, all these things are resiliency, and resiliency is a big part of it, is mitochondrial integrity.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because for years I've been telling people that the symptom of fatigue itself, the symptom of lack of resilience, the symptom of loss of endurance, of stamina, are actually more sophisticated, more accurate markers of your mitochondrial function than your organic acids test.
Exactly.
And it's hard for people to understand, because it seems much more primitive. It seems much less sciencey and sophisticated and cutting edge, but you have to actually be sophisticated with scientific literacy to understand why that's true. So I'm glad to hear you.
It must be very frustrating.
Share my views.
It must be very frustrating for you interviewing all different types of people.
It is often, yes. And I'm very happy, and to be honest, a little surprised, because to hear you say this, not because I've known you for many years now, and I know you're absolutely one of the most brilliant minds out there. But the truth is that there are many very high intelligence people who are sort of suckered into bad modes of thinking. If you don't have the right paradigm and you don't have the orientation to think critically and think for yourself, oftentimes you end up just sort of following the experts and doing what everybody else is doing, and you let groupthink go on. And there's another aspect, which I'm sure you might have some comments on, which is it, within the culture of functional medicine, I think, and also like financial incentives and marketing of all these practitioners trying to market themselves and promote themselves, there is a culture of like one-upsmanship, where different practitioners are trying to one-up each other by having a more sophisticated testing panel and the fancier tests and a fancier sounding methodology and these kinds of things. And what you're talking about and what I'm talking about here, saying, hey, the symptom of fatigue, or, which is free, you have access to it, and with a simple questionnaire, just ask yourself that question, or your resiliency or your stamina, these sorts of symptomatic markers are actually more accurate. That is less sophisticated, and from a marketing perspective, sells less well. And so I think that culture promotes this kind of environment where all these practitioners are constantly seeking fancier and fancier and more tests of various kinds.
Yeah, that's one of the red flags for me when I see a file come in from another practitioner. If they've done a lot of testing, I'm like, they're new. They don't know what they're doing. And then like the more seasoned practitioners are doing a very detailed history, and then they're making some realistic goals. Read 4 pages instead of 3. Go to the mailbox, come back. Don't get dizzy. Mm-hmm. Stand for as you can on your feet. And then those become really noticeable things to monitor. And ultimately with just chronic cases, it really is a trial and error game. And I remember talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and I'm like, listen, I'm at the point where I don't trust what anyone else says, because I don't know what their bias is and their ability to interpret the information is. I'm having a hard time trusting a lot of research, because we use a p-value of 0.05 for every study, which means if the study is perfect, 1 out of 20 are wrong, and no study is perfect. Then it's like, okay, there's only been one on this study. We don't have enough to do a meta-analysis. So, okay, I'm looking at bits and pieces of information. I'm looking at labs. And there's lab error, and then there's misguided things with what the labs can actually mean. Then you put that all together, and then you're like, okay, well, I have a bunch of stuff that may or may not be effective. And of course it's useful to see anemia on a CBC and things like that. But when you start getting into more subtle things, ultimately you're stuck in a clinical setting with, this patient can't do these things. What can we do through trial and error? And how can they potentially recover? And if they recover, that's a clue that we're hitting the right pathway when we do something to hit some improvements. And if they don't recover, then it's also diagnostic, meaning that's not where we need to go. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of go through the whole process. So I think that's like where it really ends up anyways. And I think if our patient, that can be very frustrating, because they want to get answers right away. If there's something very attractive going, oh, okay. Oh, I have mold. Oh, I have mold toxicity. Oh, I have Lyme disease. Oh, I have heavy metal toxicity. It's like just these simple things. And obviously they can spend thousands of dollars going down that rabbit hole and not really getting any outcomes. And that's what they have to be careful about. Now, I would say when it comes to mitochondria, like mitochondrial biogenesis is a key thing. The key thing with mitochondrial biogenesis is what we've been talking about, getting hormesis, getting activation, getting that proteomic message to actually make these mitochondria. And we can all make them. I mean, the more movement, the more activity we have, the more cognitive stimulation we have, the more challenges we have to our system, the more mitochondria we can make. And then the next thing is really getting rid of unhealthy mitochondria. So this whole mitophagy pathway, is we have like only so much space in a cell. And there's only so much mitochondria that can be generated in that cell. And if they're unhealthy and bad, then it's actually going to impair mitochondrial biogenesis pathways. And this, and if you look at all the research on mitophagy, the clearing out of these unhealthy mitochondria, because a period of time they just wear out. So as they make energy and ATP, these cells become less efficient, and then we have to get rid of them, and we have to get rid of them in order to have space for new ones to come in. So if this mitophagy pathway, this clearing out of unhealthy mitochondria that have kind of worn out over time, isn't working, then it's a big problem. And that goes back to just like sleep. Like you gotta have sleep. I mean, I think people don't realize physiologically the reason we have to have sleep is because we have to use all our energy to get rid of all our debris cells, yeah. Autophagy and mitophagy. So like movement activity and getting proper sleep probably is some of the best remedies for any kind of fatigue endurance issue than any nutraceutical.
Yeah. have you paid attention to this emerging line of research, and especially with Russell Ryder, around melatonin and mitochondria? There's been some pretty new, and I think we'll, when all is said and done 10, 20 years from now, I think we'll realize that this is a really important aspect of physiology. But there's this, as it stands now, 2023, it's very new research showing that mitochondria produce their own melatonin. Have you seen this research yet?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You always bring up stuff I've never heard of.
Okay, you're going to love
this.
You're
well read, so I don't know.
It's super interesting, and I think you're going to be fascinated by it. So there's Russell Ryder is probably the most well-known melatonin researcher. He's an old guy now, but he's been researching melatonin for, I think, several decades. Yeah. And some really fascinating research showing that mitochondria, so the only, it's not just the pineal gland, and it's not just the gut that's producing the supply of melatonin, but it turns out melatonin is this critically important mitochondrial antioxidant that also interacts with the internal antioxidant defense system, glutathione, superoxide dismutase, catalase, and heme oxygenase, and some of those other internal antioxidant defense system, to recharge that system at night while we sleep, along with, you know, mitophagy and all those things that lots of other beneficial things that go on. But it turns out they did experiments in mice where they removed the pineal gland, and then they measured levels of melatonin in the mitochondria. And they found that in mice with no pineal gland, that they still have the same levels of melatonin at the mitochondrial level. And then they discovered that melatonin is so important to mitochondria that mitochondria actually produce their own supply of melatonin.
Wow.
And interestingly, hormetic stress, especially exercise, stimulates an increase in that, likely to help balance the redox, help balance the oxidants that are also produced, and especially red light. So obviously we get that from the sun, but also red light devices stimulates very strongly this mitochondrial production of melatonin. Anyway, I think it's going to be an important layer of physiology, and I'll share the research with you after we get off.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I know for sure as we sleep, when the pineal gland itself is producing melatonin, it primes the immune system, it activates mitochondrial pathways for fusion, vision, and mitophagy and so forth. But yeah, that's the thing. These are interactive, you know, different types of cells. And the key thing is going back to, you have to have hormesis, you have to have stress in order to activate them. And then you have to have sleep to get rid of them. And if you're not sleeping well, and also circadian rhythms, just like a general circadian rhythm is really critical. So the other thing, like I'll do with patients that are having issues with endurance issues, and we want to rebuild their mitochondria, is again, we'll get them to move with whatever limitations they have, but try to induce hormesis so it's difficult for them. It's not like they can walk and it's no problem. We want to push it a little bit. So whether it's getting the heart rate up a little bit more or the length of time, it's something to really push their activity. And we want to do that cognitively, we want to do it physically, whatever those challenges may be. And then we really want to focus on making sure they get enough sleep and improving their sleep hygiene, but also then really trying to get their circadian rhythms working. So we get them in the pattern of just try to start waking up at the same time, eating the same time, exercise the same time, and just get this as efficient as you can for them to recover. And I got to tell you, working with people who have like brain injuries, and brain injuries is a massive insult to mitochondria and neurons, and that impacts the recovery. If we don't do those things, they can't recover. Like this, like they have to, you know, have proper sleep, proper hormesis activation, and normalizing a circadian rhythm to really make that system work. So yeah, it's like the starting place for me. And then what I like to do is kind of then go, how do they respond to their activation and stimulation? There's some people who completely crash when they try to increase their hormesis, like working out.
Yeah.
So to me,
this was my next question. I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, great. So then for me, I want to go, okay, well, how do they crash and what caused them to crash? So if it's just any kind of physical exercise, for me, I start to really think about, do they have any antioxidant reserves? That might be a trial that we do. We might like bump up a whole, you know, series of antioxidants for them, like green tea, resveratrol, turmeric, pine bark, or, you know, whatever thing, series of cocktails, alpha lipoic acid, NAC, and to see if that load over the next few weeks can start to impact their endurance.
Can I interject one thing very briefly? Yeah. Part of the reason I think this melatonin story is so significant is because it's such a strong mitochondrial antioxidant, and because it interacts with that internal antioxidant system. And given that light, specifically the red wavelengths of light, which we get from sunbathing, is probably the single most potent source of mitochondrial melatonin, I actually think that what's going to come out of this is that we realize that sunbathing is really, really important. Getting adequate sun on our bodies is much more important than just the vitamin D story that most people think. Most people think, oh, you know, I can just pop a vitamin D pill and then I can spend my whole life indoors and not getting sunlight, and the vitamin D has me covered for the benefits of sunlight. And it's like, no. If you really understand what sunlight's doing to you, you'll understand there's a lot more layers to that story than just vitamin D. And I think that we're going to figure out that this is a big one. And I think it relates to what you're just talking about there.
I think you're right. I think that's going to be huge. I think that's a whole difference. It's more than just vitamin D.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting. But, you know, it brings up the point of these antioxidants and these systems. That's another area. So that's not one of the key things that we have to make mitochondria and challenge an hormesis. We have to clear mitochondria. But the other one is mitochondria are very susceptible to free radicals, inflammatory mediators, and so forth. And so for some people that are chronically ill, they just may have their free radical, you know, pro-inflammatory load exceed their anti-inflammatory antioxidant load. And in those cases, we'll know right away. It's not as theoretical, because once we put them on a series of those compounds, it's either going to make a big difference or may not. If it doesn't, then we know that might be the issue. But for some people, they may notice some change. It may not be 100%, but it may be like 20% or 30% or something. They definitely notice it when they miss it. You know, one of the red flags for me is also when I see a chronic patient come in, they have a list of all the supplements they take. And I go, okay, you're stuck on an island. You can only take three supplements with you. Which ones are you taking? Because I don't want to take 100 supplements, you know? I'm like, what are the priorities? And if they're like, oh, I got to have my N-acetylcysteine, I've got to have my, you know, green tea, I have to have, you know, and this is like, these are all antioxidants. I'm like, okay, you just may need to boost your levels up for a little bit of time. And then we'll be much, much more cautious in the recovery. You know, and then that's where you really, like for me, that's when like, okay, I really want to take a deep dive into things that can help the mitochondria, air quality in their home. That's a huge one for me. I always like to check their air quality, make sure they have air filter, you know, their home base. So then you look at chemicals, but I'm not looking at exotic chemicals. I want to like look at chemical load in their home and then see what we can do to mitigate that. So always use air filters. We'll try to make sure that they, you know, they're using ceramics and glass, and you know, it just goes through
for cookware.
Cookware and yeah. for storage of foods and things like that. So we'll go through the whole, like, try to reduce your chemical load that way. We may even check chemical levels with, you know, different profiles and see if they have any elevated levels, and see if we need to support their biotransformation pathways and go through that. Now, that only happens with a small percentage of people. Like, that's like most, that's not everyone. And I can tell you, if I ran a chemical load profile on 100 people, I'm going to get 90 back that are abnormal.
Yeah.
Right. So it's those people that have a high chemical load, but they don't have any symptoms, they have a pretty good antioxidant, you know, biotransformation pathway that even though they have this load, it's not devastating for them, right? Mm-hmm. So, like I said, it's the other variable, the other factor. So then I'll want to, like, so then I'll, like, go through and just start to look at what things impact their bioenergetics, like what things really impact their energy levels. So let's assume they're just having intermittent fatigue. So some days are better than others, right? And, you know, they could have a bad day or a good day. So that's like what I call an intermittent fatigue patient. And with the intermittent fatigue patient, it's totally different than every day is terrible. I can't get out of bed. I can't function. I can't, that's a whole different.
What's different physiologically? Is can you?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of those people have severe autoimmunity. There's a whole list of theories related to mitochondrial autoimmunity, but they haven't been able to identify the target protein yet. But it's pretty clear that there are target proteins. There are some mitochondrial proteins that have been published on like people that have severe fatigue mechanisms. I think some of that's going on. And those are really, really difficult to turn around. It's not, those are just, how do we try to improve the quality of your life? At least in the clinical setting that skills I have to try to help them with what I can do as a functional medicine practitioner. There's some people that come in and go, okay, we got this nailed. We're going to get you fixed up. So almost, you know, and sometimes they do have like serious, there are some like examples of people actually do get mycotoxin exposures. There are people that really do have toxic mold and they really get sick from them. Pretty, you know, they're not as common as people think, but they're definitely there. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of severe illness, like a mycotoxin poisoning or something like that sometimes comes up. Sometimes I had this one person who was working and they would have these buses turn on. He's working as a manager, like a executive at a hotel. And every morning they would have a shuttle. And he would just stand in front of this gas exhaust in the shuttle and drink coffee with their coworkers. And it's like, that's a lot of benzene exposure. Can you just stop that for like 2 weeks? He's like, I feel a lot better. And it's like, okay.
It's amazing down here in Costa Rica. Everybody leaves their engine running. When their car is stopped and they're hanging out next to their car, they leave their engine running because it's so hot that they want their AC in the car going all the time. But they'll sit outside, like when we need to go to the airport or something, we have a taxi come to our house. Invariably, without exception, every one of these people will park in the driveway, get out of their car waiting for us, leaving the engine running. And so the whole process of putting the luggage in the car and getting loaded up and all that stuff for 20 minutes, you're like breathing exhaust fumes. So I have to, if I don't say anything, I will be breathing exhaust fumes. So I have to ask these people every time, and they get annoyed with me, of course, to turn the engine off. But you know, if imagine somebody doing that job where they're for hours every day breathing those exhaust fumes and they don't think anything of it.
Oh, they don't. Exactly. So those are like the things that, you know, like you take the deep dive and you start to think about it. And a lot of times, like the patient themselves, they're like, you really think it's that? I'm like, why don't we try? Just see what happens. So we'll try to find any source of chemical load we can, especially if they have a lot of difficulty with activation and movement and crash really quickly. We definitely think of chemical related issues. Blood sugar is always a big one. Like, I mean, a lot of people have blood sugar issues that will definitely impact their mitochondrial functions. We need to have glucose to make ATP. So we'll look for the classical symptoms of a dysglycemia or abnormal blood sugar levels by asking, how do you feel after you eat? And the normal answer should be not hungry. You know, if they say, I feel energized, I can focus, I can think, I can concentrate again, that's a sign they were hypoglycemic. So they may be going too long without eating and have, you know, hypoglycemic mechanisms to address. And then those that get really tired after they eat, then we think they may have some insulin resistance issues, and that could be one of the factors where they're not getting glucose into their cells to feed their mitochondria. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, you get a chronic exhausted patient and you like get them to move, develop activation of mitochondrial biogenesis, get them to sleep properly, start to get a normal circadian rhythm, stabilize their blood sugar levels. And we may have not even used any supplements at all. Mm-hmm. And they're finally starting to recover. Now the list of 100 supplements is like, mm-hmm. run away. Yeah. Now, sometimes supplements definitely do help, like nutraceuticals do help, but they're never going to work on their like own. Like there isn't a nutraceutical that's going to do those mechanisms with mitophagy and mitochondrial fusion and mitochondrial biogenesis, and it's just not going to happen. Yeah. So those are the strategies that we try to do. So it's almost really more of like a lifestyle medicine approach. Now, there are like various factors, like people do have toxic load or sometimes maybe their biotransformation pathways aren't working, but that's kind of the real game. The real game is not a nutraceutical issue. And there's people that have, for example, do have hormone deficiencies or actually do have hypothyroidism. There are people that have like underlying diseases. No one's diagnosed. They may have like early kidney disease, but they haven't run a routine blood test in like 5 years because they don't trust conventional practitioners and they're only seeing alternative, and alternative people typically don't do any routine lab work. I mean, I see a lot of that in my practice. I see the referral from one person to the next, and no one's really had a real good workup. They just kind of walked into their 5-minute medical appointment and they even show like abnormal signs of early kidney disease or some kind of potential hepatitis. Come back, we'll check it again later. And like they never go back or they get ignored. And then you like run a panel and go, you have hepatitis C. You have like, you know, you're in stage 2 kidney disease. Has no one told you? You know, that, so that happens all the time. So I think, and that happens with more people that don't have intermittent fatigue, but they're just tired all the time. You know, so mm-hmm. I think ruling out actual pathology is a key factor that gets overlooked. And there's some people that have like malignancy, early stages. And, you know, we'll see like their immune system fail, white blood cell counts drop, natural killer cells be really high or low. So we'll do like a liquid biopsy, like a gallery screening test to see if they have any fragments that'll screen for like 80 tumors at once. And even at times we'll do a full body MRI scan. And studies have shown that's been very effective to find early tumors without the radiation exposure. So it's kind of like, it's a red flag. So for me, it's like the intermittent fatigue, some days are better than others. And then we'll look more like the physiological lifestyle mechanism. If it's like fatigue all the time, then we got to rule out disease, rule out pathology. And if they are like really pathologically fatigued, where they just can't function at all, then we're really thinking that they may have, you know, this more progressed mitochondrial autoimmune type responses. And then the goal is really try to improve quality of life with whatever we can. In that case, we might put them on lots of different nutraceuticals to see whatever we can get, and just trial and error and, you know, kind of working through it. So that's how I approach it.
I want to add like one layer of context or addition to this story that you've mentioned, or this way of looking at things. There was a paper came out maybe 10 years ago or something like that, and it was basically evidence-based guidelines for physicians to treat their patients with chronic fatigue. I'm going to say evidence-based, quote unquote. It was published in the Journal of the American Family Physician. And it said, as far as how physicians should treat their patients with chronic fatigue or look to diagnose them initially, it's run a standard blood test. And they specifically said, in 95% of cases, there is nothing found on those tests in patients with chronic fatigue, nothing found that explains their chronic fatigue. So, right. You know, 95% of the time you're in the categories that you've just outlined, it's like maybe 5% is going to be in that category where there's some serious underlying disease. 95 out of 100 people who are complaining of fatigue are probably going to, you're not going to find any serious underlying pathology or disease that's present.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Mm-hmm. I would say, but that depends on your population sample too. But if you had a population sample of a person being chronically sick for a long time and not having a routine workup for a while,
yeah,
Maybe it's 7.5%. Maybe it's not 5%.
No. And well, in your demographic, like you've established yourself in this unique niche where you're like the most brilliant, you know, functional medicine practitioner who trains the functional medicine practitioners. So you're like the last resort after somebody's been to 5 or 10 or 20 other practitioners and nobody can help them and nobody figures it out. It's like, okay, now I need to go see Datis. Right. He's the guy. So I'm sure your percentage is probably like 50% have some underlying serious disease.
But most of these people, like you said, just have like these subtle things that they're not going to show up on routine lab work. They don't have disease, right? Yeah. Just have physiological things that we don't have parameters to look at. And obviously the organic acids and some of these functional medicine tests aren't going to capture that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
ultimately it goes back to, do you have more endurance? Is your endurance level changing? What interventions have you done that are changing your endurance and your energy levels? And that's like the biggest thing. I always, when I work with my patient population, I always say, listen, you're chronic. This is an emotional endurance game. Like, we have to like make a plan, write it down, check things off, circle things, go through stuff. Let your body tell us what the right response is. Mm-hmm. And unless we can go through that, well, there's no way we can figure it out. And you know, sometimes you get lucky and sometimes it takes forever. And sometimes, you know, as a practitioner, times I'll work with a patient and go, I'm totally failing you. I don't know what else to do. I'm really sorry. It's like, what? You just saved my life. And I'm like, what? Every day you're still complaining all the time. And they're like, no, my quality of life is dramatically better. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, then that's good. So, you know, it's difficult. And I think for people that are suffering from like mitochondrial issues, chronic fatigue issues, you really, a lot of the treatment is in your hands. Like, you don't really, you know, you really can activate, you really can try to focus on your sleep. You really can try to find things that, like, for example, if a person can't sleep, the question is why? Have you had a sleep study? Do you have sleep apnea? Do you have frequent urination? You know, for some reason, do you have like overactive bladder at night? Do you have a prostate issue? Do you have poor bladder muscle tone as you've gotten older that you need to contract and do some Kegel exercises? Or maybe like if you can stop urinating in the middle of the night 5 times a night, you can actually start getting rid of this mitochondrial debris and you can start to actually recover from your health. And, you know, obviously try on other pathways too, they can sleep. But those are like the fundamental things. And as a person, like you said, who sees other, you know, some of the cases other practitioners have referred to me, it's rarely ever you didn't take this supplement. Yeah. It's always like our only goal the next 2 months is to see if you can sleep from 3 hours to 6 hours. Nothing else. Like, that's what we're focused on. So, if we can't do that, we can't move on. Yeah.
Yeah. With that in mind, I want to just loop back to that paper I was just referencing. And the reason why I said, quote unquote, around evidence-based is, as far as, again, these are guidelines for physicians to treat chronic fatigue,
yeah,
patients with chronic fatigue. They offered 4 treatments.
Okay.
Number one was a recommendation to walk for half an hour a day.
Okay.
I have the least problem with that one.
Yeah.
They had cognitive behavioral therapy, okay. They had antidepressants, and they had stimulants as needed. Antidepressant wow. drugs and stimulant drugs. Those were the only 4 treatments discussed in the paper for these so-called evidence-based guidelines. To emphasize this, nutrition is not mentioned at all. Hormetic stress and mitochondrial biogenesis are not mentioned at all. Mitochondria are not mentioned at all. Sleep is not mentioned at all. Circadian rhythm is not mentioned at all in this paper. Toxins, not mentioned at all, right? Sure. None of these things are mentioned at all. So this is really a paradigm issue. This is conventional medical paradigm is seeking drug cures for diseases. And, you know, this stuff that you're talking about isn't even within their, they don't even really have the right conceptual framework to even think about these kinds of things in the right way.
Oh, I know, it's very frustrating. There was a survey the Institute of Functional Medicine did, I don't know, it was 15 years ago, it was a long time ago, and they asked the medical physicians, that jumped into functional medicine, why are you here? What was your motivating factor for learning functional medicine? And the number one answer was they got sick or a family member got sick. And then they're like, I'm not thinking through this the right way. I don't have the tools. It's not disease-based, it's physiology, functional-based. And but I think things are changing. I think, you know, the people are demanding more, the information is getting out there more. But the other thing about functional medicine too, it is a patient treatment model or patient model where we need an active participant. It's not like a passive model. Here's your beta blocker, here's your ACE inhibitor, just do what you're doing. At least your blood pressure is controlled. Here's the next polypharmacy list of things that you need to take. It's really like, okay, you've got to sleep, you've got to move, you've got to change your circadian rhythm, you know, you've got to reduce your toxic load, and then kind of going through the whole process. So for me, it just seems like the patient population that is attracted to functional medicine is highly intelligent. They're a critical thinker and they're looking deeper because they realize, I don't have disease, but I don't, you know, trust that any person anymore. And that unfortunately has led to mistrust. And now they don't get conventional workups. And then we get, you know, people that have disease that, so it's, you know, it's an ugly mess, but your paper you're mentioning is exactly right.
You know, what's interesting, I love this conversation. I always love talking to you and I always come out of it smarter and learning new things. But what's really cool in this.
Me too, by the way. Me too. I learn a lot every time.
Cool. Thank you. That's a great honor for me to hear that from someone like you. But what's really cool to me is, you know, I perceive this whole landscape of the medical paradigm and studying disease, studying pathology. And there is this like real endless, infinite complexity that you can go down with studying this disease and that disease and what are the specific biochemical mechanisms, and there's constantly new discoveries of some new layer of abnormal biochemistry associated with this disease and that disease. And the whole focus of the medical paradigm, and even lots of people within the more natural and functional medicine, is to sort of delve more and more deeply into understanding the intricacies of all this abnormal biochemistry, with the idea that eventually, when we understand that deep enough, we will find some intervention, whether it's a drug or a nutraceutical, that interrupts that pathological process, that abnormal mechanism, and that will create health.
Right.
And what I love about this conversation here with you is hearing you talk about essentially lifestyle medicine as the central thing that someone needs to get better. It's like, you have maybe more than anyone, you're more brilliant, more knowledgeable about all that crazy detailed biochemistry of all these different disease processes, 500 fold more than I am. And yet you're coming back to essentially a lot of the same recommendations that I'm arriving at without having spent so many years delving into all of that, the study of all the complex biochemistry of disease processes.
Well, I think there's an ultimate real truth. And I think when you're actually looking at working with people that are ill, like the truth is going to be what works. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be like these theoretical models of this molecule for this. And at the end of the day, I think the difference in models also, when you look at and of course, I'm not anti-medicine. You're not anti-medicine. We're not anti-medicine. We're just critical thinkers of how the medical model is being approached. But, you know, when you look at the top prescriptions, you have beta blocker, ACE inhibitor, HMG reductase inhibitor, protein pump inhibitor. Everything's blocking and inhibiting. We don't have up regulators. We don't have things turning on things. The things that turn on things are, like we talked about, hormesis and sleep and lifestyle things that make a difference. Now, there's definitely a place for nutraceuticals too. It's just, it never supersedes the other variables that are more lifestyle based in the sense. But then there are some people, like I've had some patients where like they can't sleep. They like, and maybe part of the reason they can't sleep is because they're hypoglycemic all day and they just don't make enough glycogen, so they can't get through the night. And then we have to get them to maybe eat some protein at night. And then sometimes like they can't shut down a little bit, so we may have to give them a little bit of valerian to help them start to initiate that circadian rhythm, and they'll start to sleep. And then we'll start to have them monitor the circadian rhythm. They can start to get out of the rut. But we used We didn't use we used a GABA agonist, something that's blaring root, natural, non-addictive, to try to get in some sleep, some function. So you know, a combination of those things are important. It's not like one is, you need to do a little of everything, but fundamentally, it's trying to improve physiology, improve function. And like you said, like if someone was really ill and they moved as much as they were able to, they got sun, they were around healthy people that they love to be around socially, they got to laugh, they got to have a sense of self-worth, they got some acceptance, they ate real food, they slept well, they're probably going to be healthy. It's like when those things get the story where things go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Karazian, I absolutely love this conversation, and it is always a great pleasure and honor to speak with you. Are there any final thoughts that you want to leave people with, maybe especially for people dealing with complex chronic illness who have been struggling for a long time? Anything you want to say to them?
Well, I would say you can do a lot of things on your own. Like, you don't have to. First of all, if you're passive, you won't get better. If you're a passive patient and just want to have someone recommend some things for you, you won't get out of chronic disease. Getting out of chronic disease requires active participation on your part. So if you're fatigued and tired, the things we talked about are really critical. Like, you have, for example, if you have chronic pain and you have chronic fatigue issues, you have to get some movement in. You don't have to go and run a mile or something. You just need to do whatever movement your body can handle, and then just a little bit more, the hormesis effect. That will have a profound impact, especially if you monitor it over 1 week, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, to see what it does to your system and physiology. It will be painful and difficult emotionally every time you have to do it. But that's really kind of what it takes to pull through with it. And if you could just get that in, and then really try to figure out if you're sleeping well, what you can do for sleep. And maybe the reason you're on this summit is because you have mitochondrial issues and fatigue and exhaustion issues, and you can't recover. And those two little things that you could be control of and no one else can be profound. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's one thing I want to draw attention to that I love about the way you've talked about things is self-experimentation. Like, you've talked about as a practitioner that you're kind of going through this deductive process of figuring out, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, let's experiment with this, let's experiment with that. And I want people to hear, like, Dr. Karazian is one of the most brilliant minds in all of medicine, and he doesn't have, like, hey, I've got the answer, you just do step one, step two, step three, and I fix everyone instantly. It's a process of figuring things out. And as individuals listening to this, what I want to get across to you is you should also be seeking as much knowledge as possible, become as scientifically literate as possible, and operate from the principles and the paradigm that's been outlined here by Dr. Karazian, and then try to have an attitude, a positive attitude, being, as he said, proactive about trying new things and experimenting and being part of your own solution rather than just sort of being a passive patient. So
yeah, I agree. I would say one last thing.
Yeah, please.
The one key factor in my career I've seen really make a difference for outcomes, unrelated to the disease, a sense of purpose. And now there's all this new research on longevity, that's a key factor in longevity too. So you got to also make sure you have a sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Karazian, where can people find you, follow your work, get in touch with you? Where do you want to direct people?
I just have a website called Dr. K News, drknews.com. That's the main place to go if you're interested in things we're doing.
Thank you so much, my friend. It is always a pleasure to chat with you, and I look forward to the next one.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family. Help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.